Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. This is a very, very special episode. I have with me Joe Schmid, and man, I don't know, it's like maybe five or six times that he's been on. This is like a culmination, because he's on to talk about his new book, Existential Inertia, and Classical Theistic Proofs. I hope that's the title. I have it digital. Usually I like to, it's in my hand, but Joe's book is $1,000. No, it's not. I'm really excited to talk with him about this. It's a huge project, a huge work. It's awesome. I'll save it for when we bring him in here. But before we jump in, thanks to everyone who's making this possible on Patreon. You guys are awesome. I seriously appreciate the support. Like, the lights are on because of you guys, partially. If you guys like this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can find the link in the description, wherever you're getting this podcast at. Seriously, huge. Appreciate it. That is where you can support me at. Please do that. You can also buy Parker's Pensies merch from the merch store. If you're watching on YouTube, you can find that down here somewhere. If not somewhere else, then look in the description. Struggling with my intro here. I'm all jazzed about Joe being on again. So let's just bring Joe in. We're going to talk about existential inertia. Like, what the heck is that? You'll see. And then we're going to talk about some theistic proofs. So stay tuned and keep watching. You'll be an expert in classical theism and why you shouldn't believe in it, I guess, and a bunch of arguments for God's existence. So without further ado, here's Joe. Joe, man, I'm pumped to be talking with you. Thanks for coming back on the show yet again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I am now, I think I'm rivaling Taylor Sear. I think I might be tied with him now.
You have to be. Yeah, you've been on a bunch, dude. And people love hearing from you. Actually, we split one of the episodes into two, so I think that counts as double.
Ooh.
So you might be beaten. I think you're beating Taylor. Sorry, Taylor.
Ooh.
But come on soon again. Dude, okay, so I think I got the book title right. Is it Existential Inertia and Classical Theistic Proofs?
Yes, it is. So this is just my little soft cover. I don't even have my author copies yet. Those are, I believe, in the mail.
Nice.
But yeah, those are going to be the nice hard cover. This is the soft cover. It has a little thing on the bottom. That's not in the actual cover. But yeah, Existential Inertia and Classical Theistic Proofs that I co-authored with Dr. Daniel J. Linford.
Dude, so awesome. Such a huge accomplishment, man. That's awesome. Real quick, like, why this book? Why now? And let's start with that. Yeah, like, why write this book now, I guess?
Yeah, so there are probably dozens of reasons for why I wrote the book and wrote it with my co-author. I'll just give five, I think. One of them is that there's a huge need for this book at this time right now. Like, there's just a huge scholarly need for it. As we emphasize at multiple places in the book, there's a big absence of literature on existential inertia, on Fazer's proofs in particular, or, you know, 30 billion air quotes around proofs, but Fazer's arguments and lots of the issues that we cover, right? So, I mean, in terms of papers that have been explicitly published on existential inertia, you could probably count them on one or two hands. So this represents the first book-length treatment of existential inertia that exists. So, yeah, there's just a huge scholarly need for it. Yeah. And there's also a huge scholarly need for Fazer's proofs. The only critical appraisals that exist currently of any of Fazer's five proofs are me and Graham Oppie. We have only the only ones who have been publishing on it.
Yeah.
And we've only focused on stage one of the proofs, which is the Aristotelian proof. So right. This systematically goes through all five of them and goes through lots of different arguments as well, like the Deante argument from Aquinas, the first way from Aquinas, the argument for God from logic, from Anderson and Welty and Proust and Rasmussen and lots of stuff. So yeah, there's just a huge need for it. That's the first thing. The most important reason. I guess the second reason is just, I definitely think it'll serve people who are interested in these sorts of debates about God's existence, God's nature, models of God, how God relates to the world, why things persist. Why are there composite things? Why are there contingent things? Why are there changing things? Lots of these really fundamental questions in metaphysics, philosophy of religion, philosophy of time, etc.
Yeah.
I guess a third reason is much of my research and my papers have been kind of thematically united, and so they naturally lend themselves to a book-length project. They've been united around kind of a core of issues relating to persistence, What explains persistence? Classical theism, divine simplicity, arguments for and against the classical theistic God's existence, etc. So I found a natural home for like two or three of my articles in here. I think it's just two of them, and then some snippets from another one. So that's another thing. It's just kind of like a culmination of my research over the past several years.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And then I guess a fourth thing is that, I mean, hey, it helps my grad school applications. Hopefully it'll help when I eventually am seeking a job in philosophy. I mean, I know the job market there is atrocious, so don't get me wrong. I've got backup plans.
That's good.
But a published book will hopefully at least help a little bit.
Yeah.
And then fifthly and finally, I think it's a nice way to combat the kind of triumphalism and chest thumping and condescension and tribalism that spews forth from some people. So that's kind of a fifth reason. Yeah. Just a lot of people on the internet have employed Fazer's book and used it to call people irrational, calling the arguments insuperable or irrefutable demonstrations, saying that atheists aren't part of the real debate, etc. So like these sorts of things, you know, like Fazer ended his book with quod erat demonstrandum, which is like how you end like a geometric proof, which suggests that these are like on epistemic par with geometric proofs. So, yeah, just combating a lot of this kind of language of proof and demonstrate and you're irrational. You know, I'm not attributing all this to Fazer, but, a lot of people on the internet like to wield Fazer's proofs in order to bash people on the head, in order to chest thump, etc. So it's kind of combating that toxicity and arrogance and condescension and tribalism that issues forth from certain internet spheres.
Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah, we had a good laugh about the insuperable stuff before.
Last time.
Which is always
Fazer describes some of his arguments as insuperable.
Yeah.
Oh man.
And I, you know, an open invitation to him, Dr. Fazer, to come on, man. I'd love to talk with you. I really appreciate this work. For a lot of different reasons, but like, hey, if you're not a classical theist, this can bolster you as well. Like it's for everyone. And if you are a classical theist, like, man, I just think that you need to read this kind of work to see like, what are the arguments against it and how will this like shape or reshape or what kind of work do I have to do in order to explicate my view? Mm-hmm. I run in like, you know, theologian and philosopher circles. And sometimes when my theologian friends just kind of put forward classical theism, without argument, it's like, well, you know that there's like pretty like strong arguments against those. Like, you can't just say that, you know, like, if you come with some kind of reason and you say like, well, okay, here's why, and here's this, and here's that, that's cool too. Like, do that. Sure. But if you're just like, that's just the way it is, that's just Christianity, it's like, that's frustrating, man. There's a lot of stuff that you need to, there's a lot of work that you need to do to catch up. So yeah,
I just want to briefly comment on that.
Yeah.
Like, this book is going to be of serious interest to non-classical theists. So I'm not just talking about people who are, like, not classical theists. I'm talking about non-classical theists who are indeed theists, but maybe they don't accept this uber high octane Thomistic divine simplicity, because after all, that's what at least a large number of Fazer's proofs are trying to get at. And so theists themselves need to contend, who don't accept classical theism or don't accept Fazer's version of it, they themselves need to contend with these arguments, right? Yeah. So it's not like this is a book that's only of interest to atheists or, you know, things like that. Like, even non-classical theists need to have something to say in response to these arguments. Like, these arguments represent arguments even against their own view. It's not like they're united behind this sort of natural theological project, because it directly contradicts their model and their view of God.
Right, right. And for me, as my audience knows, like, I would love to be able to hold on to like simplicity, for instance, just because of the historical significance that's been given. But to me, it's like, this seems more like a liability than like a tool. Like, people be like, yo, it's a great tool. I don't see it. I see it as a total liability. But like, your criticism, part of your criticism of the conceptualist proof, the Augustinian proof, is like, hey, look, this and simplicity do not go together. And for me, I'm like, yeah, okay. So like, simplicity is out, and let's see if I can run this. Because you have a specific target in mind, which is Ed Fazer, right? So... Mm-hmm.
Well, classical theists as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But classical theists, likewise, Ed Fazer is not the stand-in for all classical theism, right?
That,
like,
is very true.
I think that's another point to make, where it's like, yeah, he's a good philosopher. But like, if you can speak for yourself too, if you're a classical theist, you know, like, maybe find your own way through here, if you can. So I just like it, man. I like the whole project. I'm excited for it. Before we jump into some of the like the nitty-gritty, can you tell us... a little bit about like your co-author, because a lot of people who know you've been working on this, and then you see your co-author and like, oh, where'd this come from? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my co-author is Dr. Daniel J. Linford. He just received his PhD in philosophy from Purdue University in early June. So yeah, he's a very recent graduate. He did his dissertation, which is actually freely available online. It is superb. It is called Cosmic Skepticism and the Beginning of the Universe. So he did it in kind of the intersection between philosophy of religion and philosophy of physics. So he is huge in philosophy of physics, in space-time, philosophy of science, philosophy of math, and also philosophy of religion. And he just the intersection of all of these together, and metaphysics and philosophy of time. So he brings a lot of that to the plate. And what he allows is kind of updating a lot of the existential inertia and classical theistic proof literature, and updating that in terms of what does all of this look like in accordance with our best scientific theories that we currently accept. Like, how does this look with our findings of relativity theory and the relativity of simultaneity and, you know, these sorts of things? How does all that look? We talk about simultaneous causation in here, which has a lot to do with interpretations of relativity and, you know, interpretations of Feynman diagrams and other sorts of things. So he brings a lot of... technical sophistication with respect to philosophy of physics in the book, and he also brings a lot of insights into like atemporal wave function monism as an alternative, timeless, foundational, non-theistic reality that has to do with a gap problem. So he brings a lot of that to the table. So a big shout out to Daniel
That dissertation sounds awesome. I'm gonna have to check that out. Maybe I can get
it's
him on the
technical,
pod.
Just a warning.
That's awesome. Well, okay, dude. It's right in the book title, Existential Inertia, and I think a lot of my audience will not know what the heck that is. So, can you give us maybe like a broad scope, and then we can dive in deeper into the details of existential inertia?
Yeah. So, I guess we can kind of situate where existential inertia is coming into the dialectic, and then I will talk about what it is. So the broad dialectic in this book, there are other kind of dialectics, the dialectical contexts, but one of them is what we call persistence arguments. Persistence arguments say something like, there are entities of a given kind, like maybe changeable entities or composite entities or entities in which essence and existence are distinct, or contingent entities. So there are entities of a given kind. That's kind of like a first premise in persistence arguments. The second premise in persistence arguments say, hey, entities of that kind require a sustaining cause or a conserving cause that keeps them in being at any moment at which they exist. So entities that are changeable or composite or contingent, or in which essence and existence are distinct, they require some kind of sustenance or conservation from without in order to exist at any moment. And then the third premise basically says, well, hey, if each of these things requires a sustaining cause, what about that sustaining cause? Is that of the same kind as these things are? If so, then it requires a sustaining cause. And is that sustaining cause of the same kind? Well, then that would then also require a sustaining cause. And what they say is that this cannot proceed to infinity, right? You can't have, so they say, you can't have an infinite chain, infinitely descending chain with no primary or foundational member that can bestow the relevant causal power, or in this case, bestow existence to the rest of the chain.
Yeah.
And so we get that there's a primary or foundational member of this chain. And it's primary in the sense of it doesn't have a further sustaining cause. And since every entity of kind K that we were just talking about, we can let that kind be contingent or changeable or whatever, since every entity of that kind requires a sustaining cause, and this entity doesn't have a sustaining cause, it follows that this entity is not of that kind. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be changeable, or it's not going to be composite, or it's not going to be contingent, etc. So then they get to this unchangeable, simple, first cause, etc. And then you can start to run stage two and things like that. That's a very broad brushstrokes of what persistence arguments are.
Yeah.
And that's where kind of existential inertia comes in. It's saying, well, hold on a second. Let's not be so quick to demand an external sustaining cause of things' existence. Why think that? Why can't things just persist in existence without requiring or without even having some kind of external sustaining cause? Why can't that be the case? What's so bad about that? It's similar to how, you know, if you shoot a particle in like in a room or whatever, the particle is just going to maintain its rectilinear motion unless it's obstructed by something.
Right.
It doesn't need some kind of continual impetus to kind of keep it going. No, it just you know, it's called spatial inertia or mechanical inertia. If that's the case in the case of spatial motion, why can't it be the case for existence? So that's a basic idea of existential inertia. I guess a little bit more precise way of putting it is temporal concrete objects. So concrete objects are just like, you know, individuals or substances or concrete particulars. So like you or me or tables or chairs or trees or particles or platypuses or even God or Cartesian egos.
Yeah.
So temporal, that means they exist within time. They undergo succession. So we're talking about temporal concrete objects. So existential inertia says that temporal concrete objects, at least some of them, maybe all of them, but at least some of them,
mm-hmm.
persist in existence in the absence of a continuously concurrent sustaining cause that keeps them in existence from without. And in the absence, of course, of like sufficiently destructive factors.
Right. Yeah.
So things persist unless they're positively destroyed by some sort of by something either within them or outside of them. And they also persist without being continuously sustained by an external sustaining cause that's outside of them and that continuously keeps them in being. So that's the basic idea of existential inertia. And you can see how that targets persistence arguments, given the way that I laid them out earlier. So yeah, that's a basic thesis.
Yeah, that's super helpful. The destructing forces, like, I wonder if someone in the audience might just be like, well, what about like entropy? Isn't entropy like a universal, like, destructive force? Isn't that just a, like, have you thought about that? Is that an appropriate question, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. We actually talk about that a little bit in one of the paragraphs. I mean, yeah, I mean, existential inertia is perfectly cool with entropy. That just means that, yeah, there is a destructive force that's often, you know, acting on things. And, you know, it's not always a sufficiently destructive causal force. I mean, after all, like, I can punch you. There's a sense in which that's a destructive force. Like, if I did it more and more and more often, then you'd die. So it's like a partial, cause of it.
Yeah.
And it's not by itself sufficient for it. And so entropy, whenever it's acting on things like you and me right now, it's not a sufficiently destructive cause, but you know, it's a causal vector that's kind of pushing us towards that way. But of course, it's not sufficient for it. So,
and it's not like,
that's a basic idea.
Yeah. I guess we don't need to like reify it or anything. Like, entropy is like a thing. It's like a concrete entity out there either. It's like, it's just like a fill in the blank type thing for anything that, I guess I don't know what entropy is.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like facts about statistical mechanics and distribution of like particles and their energies within systems or something, you know? Again, I don't really see how, I mean, it's an interesting thought because it's like sort of a destructive factor. But again, that's really just going to amount to certain particles having certain properties in our environment as well as within us that undergo certain processes.
Yeah.
And those can, when they're sufficient, they can cause us to cease to exist. But they're not always going to be sufficient. And when they're not sufficient, the thing is going to persist in the absence of external sustenance.
Yeah. So when it comes to a thing persisting, do you only need one? Like, you talk about in the book, you know, you are more precise. You say like, not all things, but at least some things, at least some concrete objects persist. Like, all you need is one for the argument to go through, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all you would need, yes, all you need is one for our existential inertia thesis, as we call it, or EIT. That's the kind of precise way to put the thesis. All you would need is one temporal concrete object that behaves in this manner, that, as we call it, inertially persists.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like if there's a temporal God, for instance, that's going to satisfy this, because God persists without being sustained in existence from without, and also in the absence of sufficiently destructive factors, of course. So that's kind of trivial.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, even if there's a temporal God, like that's perfectly compatible with existential inertia. And that's also compatible with this temporal God sustaining every other temporal concrete object, right? Because again, our existential inertia thesis only quantifies over temporal concrete objects or some subset thereof.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's compatible with that. I mean, you might think that there are different views here. Some people think that, yeah, I mean, basically every temporal concrete object is going to behave in this way. And other people who are less inclined to that are going to think differently.
Yeah. So another thing I wanted to broach for the audience is in persistence conversations, sometimes there's a debate over like perdurantism and endurantism. And yeah, you're like, hey, either one works with existential inertia. Can you explain that a little bit more? Maybe just say like a word about per and endurantisms.
Yeah. So endurantists think that objects persist by being wholly located at the moments at which they exist, or being wholly present to mm-hmm. each moment at which they exist. So you and I are here right now. That the endurantist says that like the whole of us, like the entirety of us as concrete objects, are present here right now. And then at the next moment, the whole entirety of us is present there at that moment. And then at the next moment, the whole entirety of us is then present at that moment. Mm-hmm. So yeah, endurantists say that things persist by being wholly present or existing as a whole at the respective moments at which they exist, at each of the respective moments at which they exist. By contrast, perdurantists say, no, that's not the case. You do not exist. You are not wholly present at each of the moments at which you exist. Instead, there's something like temporal parts. So you persist by having parts at each of these times. So you are not talking to the whole of Joe right now. You're just talking to a temporal part of Joe, or maybe it's a temporal phase of Joe. And I am just this four-dimensional space-time worm strung out through space-time. I think, who is it? Catherine Rogers likes to call them space-time ribbons because worms is a bit distasteful,
right,
unless you're a Calvinist. So
that's right.
So yeah, we're space-time ribbons. We, as a whole, we are those like space-time salamis, if you want to think about it like that.
Yeah.
So we do not persist by being wholly present at each of the moments at which we exist. Instead, we're only partly present there. It's a part of us that's there.
Yeah.
We are the four-dimensional objects that are strung out or extended through space-time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Joe, just like, dude, this is not part of the book or anything, but do you come down on that? I would assume that you're probably a perdurantist, but
so I think? Yeah. So I used to be much more in favor of presentism and endurantism together.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm kind of agnostic. I've been talking with Daniel a lot. And,
that's a surprise, you know, that you're agnostic, yeah, on something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, these debates are immensely complex.
And, right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to come around to the view that, yeah, relativity really does kind of push us toward, I know, I mean, it won't strictly entail it, but it really does kind of push us toward a four-dimensionalist view, and the consequent upon which, I would argue, is something like perdurantism.
Yeah.
So I'm still agnostic on it, but my views are kind of in flux. And this is kind of a recent development. So,
oh, cool.
People who have been following me for a long time know that I used to call myself a lukewarm presentist, but now I just don't really know anymore.
Yeah. Well, so I'm with you on that, man. It's like, it's super tough. And you speak to someone who's more convinced on one side or the other. No one's really convinced, but like, and they'll give you amazing arguments. You're like, dang it, dude. I don't even want to hear it anymore. Like, I don't want to change my mind anymore. But no matter what, both of you are crazy. Like, I'm wholly here. But then, like, that moment passed. And now I'm just gone.
And you have different properties, right? You have different properties now than you did then. It's like, how are you with the exact...
But like, the space-time thing, the space-time ribbon, with the nice way of saying it, is so weird too. It's like, no, but I am here. What are you talking about? It's like, both of them are so crazy, man.
Yeah, like, metaphysics is hard and crazy. Yeah. It's like, the more you study it, you're like, okay, there's a range of views on this question. You have to take one of them because it's like, like, oh my gosh, they all have so many weird counterintuitive consequences. And you're like, oh, boy.
Yeah. And the world's just weird. Like, no matter what comes out, unless there's another option that's not weird, which it doesn't seem, I don't see it yet. Like, they're all super weird. So no matter what you say, like, the world is a weird place, which I kind of like. I kind of go in for that. Well, so okay, let's get back to some existential inertia stuff. Do you, to me, like, it popped up on my radar a couple years back from you, and then some debates back and forth, some papers flying around. But, like, where did this, do you know where this came from? Like, who started this kind of stuff? Do you know?
You're asking someone who likes analytic philosophy about history.
I thought you might know. I don't know.
No, I mean, okay, so, you know, debates, like, this kind of goes back to, like, the pre-Socratic atomists. So, like, they thought that, you know, like,
the world
is fundamentally composed of these indestructible atoms. And they are, like little BB atoms almost, indestructible atoms. And they are the fundamental things of reality. Yeah. They are temporal. They persist. They are not sustained or, you know, conserved by anything more fundamental than them. And they go, like, they go on to constitute and in some manner explain the diversity of composite things around us.
And they swerve, and that's why we get free will and stuff. And that's great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the pre-Socratic atomists were kind of the first existential inertialists.
Okay.
I want to emphasize for the audience, right? Like, I'm not an atomist. I don't accept these sorts of pre-Socratic views. Existential inertia is not tied to these sorts of things. That's just one way to be an existential inertialist. You could also be a Bible-thumping Christian and accept existential inertia. You can believe in a temporal God. You could be a panentheist, a neoclassical theist, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or you could be like a neo-Aristotelian. You can have basically any, almost any metaphysical view of, you know, the fundamental structure of reality. Almost any, of course. But yeah, so it kind of goes back to the pre-Socratic atomists. And, you know, this is, the view is refined, taken up in different ways. You know, the medieval, not medieval, like the early modern, like atheist philosophers, like D'Holbach, and I'm probably pronouncing these terribly, and,
that's fine. You're on Parker's Pensies, man. You're good.
Yeah. I think Montaigne or whatever his person's name is. Sorry. I don't know philosophy. I don't know history.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think they tried to, you know, ascribe to like the universe. They argued that we can basically ascribe to the universe a lot of the attributes that theists traditionally argued applied to God. And, you know, they got around cosmological arguments like that. And so they also, a lot of them held that like either the universe or certain fundamental constituents thereof persist inertially. Like Leibniz has this interesting idea of like, was it Leibniz? I think there was this thing called it was either Leibniz or Spinoza. I'm revealing my ignorance here.
Mm-hmm.
There's like this doctrine of striving or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's almost like things are in some manner continually, like they strive for existence and they strive for persistence or something. And they like, in some manner, they explain their own persistence. So that's almost like another existential inertialist view, or at least, you know, you could develop one on the basis of that. It's kind of like the forerunner to something.
Yeah. I wonder if that's like Leibniz's monadology or something. Sounds like,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know either.
I think, and then more recently it kind of comes up in Mortimer Adler in his 1980 book. He talked about it as a, you know, one way of responding to certain traditional cosmological arguments that rely on sustaining causation. And then
did he use that word? Do you know, did he use existential?
As far as I know, he is the first person to use that term anywhere. Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't know that you would know Mortimer Adler. Cause he was kind of like a popular, you know, philosopher type dude. That's really cool. He's like one of my favorite people. I love Mortimer Adler.
Really?
This set back here is all Mortimer Adler's like collection of the great works.
Oh my gosh.
I love this guy, man. He's
awesome.
That's so cool that I started, or that he like coined it. I don't know, but at least
I'm pretty confident that he's the first person to coin the term.
That's insane. That's so cool. Okay.
But yeah. And then, you know, it doesn't really get talked about much. And then it's picked up by John Bowdoin, and he writes a paper on it. And he argues that like existential inertia is definitely better than these sorts of divine conservation views.
Yeah.
And then Fraser responds to Bowdoin, and then you get a little bit more of a proliferation of papers on the basis of that exchange. And that's kind of been continuing up till now. Every now and then I'll find like a really weird dissertation that like mentions something like existential inertia in like one paragraph. And
yeah,
it's really interesting. And they'll call it like persistence continuity, or, you know, something. It's like something weird. And I'm like, okay. So yeah, every now and then I'll find little snippets of it, but yeah.
So it's fascinating because I think I can see why, like, a classical theist, there's like a pious argument to be made where it's like, look, if you're a theist, then like you want to say that God holds things in existence. Like it's because of him that we all continue to exist and he holds all things together. Maybe you're quoting scripture there. I could see that. And then you're like, oh, well, we have this doctrine. And so there I can start making some arguments based off this view. But you could just as easily be like, well, hey, look, God created it and created it such that it will continue unless a destructive force acts on it. You know, like you could, I think it's just as easy to be a theist and be an, you already said it earlier, but do you think it's just as easy to be a theist on either side of the coin?
So we should get some clarifications here.
Yeah.
Remember that existential inertialists, in order to be an existential inertialist, at least in order to accept EIT as we define it, mm-hmm. all you need to hold is that, you know, there's at least one temporal concrete object that persists in the absence of external sustenance and sufficient destruction.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all you need. So a theist who is a temporal, who they think that God is temporal, which he is, by the way. No, I'm kidding. a theist who accepts divine temporality, they are thereby going to be accepting existential inertia, even if they think that God holds and sustains absolutely everything else in being and conserves it at each moment at which it exists. Because, again, they have that one, at least one thing which satisfies that thesis. They could also hold, shall we say, a more unrestricted existential inertialist view. And instead of giving God that lone status of persisting inertially, they could also afford that to the things around us. Like, yeah, God's needed to, let's say, create them initially, but they persist of their own accord, as it were, after God kicks things off. So that's another way to be a theist and an existential inertialist. Now, as you just pointed out, there are really interesting questions here about, if you already have theistic commitments, which of these two should you prefer? Let's just bracket off the divine timeless views. So if you're a temporal God theorist, which of these two views should you prefer? It's interesting because you might think that there are, like, this could be stuff for future research. There, you know, you could think about perfect being theology. All else being equal, we want our theory to make God better in some way. We want our theory to make God as best as possible.
Yeah.
Now you might think that, hey, God's better if, like, everything else, like, just continually is sourced in God. Like, you might think that if everything's so radically dependent on God and God's the uniquely radically independent thing, you might think that that makes God better in some way. It adds to his greatness or glory or something. So that's one thought, and I do see that intuition. But you might also think, as you just pointed out, like, you could imagine someone who accepts the kind of unrestricted existential inertialist view, a theist who accepts it, mind you, and they're like, your God is impotent. He's like, he can't even create, like, a world that can exist apart from him, that can at least persist apart from him. So, like, you know, like, what? Your God needs to, like, continually, you know, try to keep it from falling out of existence, you know?
Yeah. It's like a spinning plate. Yeah. I always think it's like God, this God can make a spinning plate and then let it go and keep spinning. Like, that's pretty impressive. The other one's like, oh, I got to spin this one. You know, like, you could pitch it that way. Yeah,
exactly. So they're like, it might add to God's glory that he can create a world like that he doesn't need to, like, continually, like, keep it in existence from, like, falling out into non-being. You might think that. So, I mean, maybe there are intuitions on both sides. And that's an interesting project for theists. Like, look at different perfect being intuitions and see which of these two might be preferable. I mean, again, you know, you might argue that scripture already decisively tells in favor of the sustenance view, etc. I've actually met Christians who are like, yeah, existential inertia, the unrestricted one, is just obvious. Of course things just, they told me, I'm like, well, like, don't you think that, like, church tradition and things like, they're like, no, I'm a Protestant, or, you know, they say things like that. And I'm like, okay. But it's been interesting. And I brought up the regular passages to them, and they were able to, like, give, like, coherent responses to them that don't require God to, like, sustain things. And I was like, whoa. So maybe there is some room here.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'll pass that. I mean, the listeners, like, take that up, you know, let's, I want to hear more about it. That'd be fascinating. Joe, what do you think, like, what are some of the, is there a best argument against existential inertia or the EIT thesis, the EIT, I guess, can't call it a thesis if you include the T in there. Is there a best one, or is there a couple best ones that you've been like, oh, that's, That's fascinating.
Is there a best one? Or a few best ones?
Best possible one, maybe?
I mean, there are some ones that are, like, interesting and suggestive. The thing is, like, existential inertia, like, it is compatible with so many different, like, worldviews and positions that it's actually pretty good. Like, you can afford yourself of different resources to respond to objections. Like, if someone says, contingent things require a cause, etc., they're like, well, I mean, existential inertia is compatible with there being a temporal necessary thing, which is at the foundation of reality. Maybe it's even God. You know, like, it's compatible with theism. Like, it's actually somewhat, as we argue in the book, like, given the whole panoply of metaphysical accounts of existential inertia, as well as given the way that we articulated it, like, the only way you can, like, refute it, essentially, is to show that there is a sustaining, concrete, timeless thing, or there's a timeless, concrete thing which continuously sustains absolutely every temporal, concrete object. And that's, I don't know, that's difficult. I mean, the classical theistic proofs, I think, are themselves just the best candidates to try to establish such a thing. They try to get to a timeless God, and that's how they try to do it. I guess, okay, here's how I would argue against existential inertia. I would first, so I don't think any of the arguments that we examine in this book against existential inertia, I don't think any of them succeed. But here's how I would do it if I were a theist. Give an independent argument for God's existence that doesn't have to do with persistence.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, talk about psychophysical harmony, or talk about maybe, like, fine-tuning, or, you know, something. So get to God's existence. Get to a perfect being. Then try to argue that this perfect being would have to be timeless. So don't do that from, like, persistence considerations, but, you know, like, just say things like, well, hey, four-dimensionalism is true, and if four-dimensionalism is true, then God can't be temporal, because then you'd have this, like, four-dimensional God worm thing, and there would be, like, time slices that are each numerically distinct from God, but that are uncaused, that are necessary, that are omniscient, that are omnipotent. So, like, there are things numerically distinct from God that are omniscient and omnipotent. Like, that's incompatible with traditional monotheism.
Right.
So you could, like, say that four-dimensionalism is true, and therefore God is timeless. That's the only really plausible way that you could have a timeless God. You might argue that. And if God is timeless and he's perfect, you draw on these perfect being intuitions that we've been talking about, like, plausibly, if God is perfect, he's going to be the uniquely independent thing, and everything else is going to be owing to God at any moment at which it exists.
Yeah.
He's going to have to be radically independent. That's a perfection. And so you just get that there's this timeless thing that sustains everything else. And it's kind of an indirect route, but that's because it's hard to refute existential inertia directly.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah, I like that. I like that approach. Yeah, that's good. Well, okay, so we talked about off air a little bit about how once you have existential inertia in place, some of Fazer's proofs it falls out of existential inertia that these proofs aren't successful. So you cover, I think, like, 7 proofs in the book. Is that right?
Yeah, so we do cover 7 of them. I could just briefly say which 7 they are. I mean, we cover actually more than 7. It's slightly...
Oh, yeah, that's right. You added a couple into one. Yeah.
It's slightly, yeah. So the 7 are, and these are the arguments for classical theism that we look at. We also look at, I guess I should say, several different arguments against classical theism as well. So the 7 are for classical theism that we look at. Aquinas' first way, the Aristotelian proof, which is Fazer's Neoplatonic proof, Fazer's Augustinian proof, that's like the theistic conceptualism one. And in that chapter, we also look at Anderson and Welty's case for God's existence. We also look at Proust and Rasmussen's case based on theistic conceptualist reasoning, etc. Then we look at the Thomistic proof, the rationalist proof, and then finally Aquinas' De Ente argument from essence, existence, composition. Those are the ones for classical theism that we look at.
Yeah. Okay, dude, like, you've done videos where they're like 12 hours long, and I love those, and I've listened to them. And I've listened to some portions twice, but we can't do that here. I wonder if we could, like, hop through just like a you know, really high up view and just talk about how existential inertia deals with those or interacts with or refutes. So, like, just starting with one, Aquinas' first way, you guys say that this first way, you know, reasons from change to a purely actual unmoved mover. And this is chapter 2 of the book. How does existential inertia interact with Aquinas' first way?
It doesn't. So no, it's interesting. This one is interesting because sort of in the beginning, we articulate, you know, how I was articulating persistence arguments earlier and the kind of abstract structure that they instantiate. We also look at two kind of different types of arguments in this book. One of them is, you know, the Augustinian proof. That has nothing to do with existential inertia. That's kind of like just abstract objects, right? Mm-hmm. So existential inertia doesn't tackle that one. And so I forget what we call those kinds of arguments. I don't think we gave a name to them. But there's also another kind of argument that we examine in this book, and it's the argument from change. And that one actually doesn't focus on explaining things as existence, right? So existential inertia, which is focused on explaining things as existence at their non-first moments of their existence, right? Existential inertia is kind of going to be irrelevant to that because it's focusing on a different explanandum. It's focusing on change. Like, why is there change? And you try to explain that in terms of a purely actual unchangeable being. So in short, existential inertia doesn't quite tackle that one. Now, I should say there are some interpretations of Aquinas's five ways that make them almost identical to Aquinas's Deante argument. Mm-hmm. And then it would challenge them. Yeah. But I'm going on a different interpretation, as we say in the book. We're going on a different interpretation that focuses on change and just explicitly change and the actualization of potential. So yeah.
Yeah, that's. I thought that was really helpful because and the Augustinian proof are, you could hold to those and hold to existential inertia, but there's maybe independent reasons why you wouldn't be, for instance, for the Augustinian proof, why there's problems if you are a classical theist for holding that, because, you know, God's supposed to be simple and he's got all these numbers in his head, then like it doesn't look like he's simple. So, boom. Well, let's jump on to Aristotelian proof. This reasons from change and the existence of change, the existence of changeable substances to a purely actual unactualized actualizer. Existential inertia challenges this.
Yeah. So one thing I should say before explaining the proof and how existential inertia challenges it is that there are a lot of different challenges to each of these arguments. Right. We give a really nice summary at the end. One of the reviewers, the anonymous reviewers for the book, the anonymous referees for the book, really enjoyed the concluding chapter because it like really nicely summarizes like the central criticisms that we lay out, that we lay to like each of the arguments, and we do it in numbered form, etc. There are a lot of different criticisms of this, but one among the many is existential inertia. Now, what is the argument? Well, we actually did a podcast episode on that. So if people want to check into this further, we did a podcast on the Aristotelian proof. It's on one of the chapters or one of the papers that I wrote and that I revised to include in this book. Mm-hmm. So the proof roughly and basically in super simple terms, it says there are beings that can undergo change. It's kind of obvious. Premise two, beings that can undergo change require a sustaining cause.
Yeah.
Premise three, chains of those sustaining causes cannot be infinite. And so it follows that there's an uncaused sustaining cause of those things. And since things that can undergo change require a sustaining cause, and this thing doesn't have a sustaining cause, it follows that this thing cannot undergo change.
Yeah.
And so it's a purely actual, it doesn't have any potentialities for change. So it's a purely actual, unchangeable first cause, we can say. Mm-hmm. So that's like a super simplified way to run the argument, much simpler than Fraser's 50 premise proof. Again, proof in like 30 billionaire quotes.
Yeah.
So that's a basic thrust of the argument. And which premise does it target? Well, of course, it targets that one where it says beings that can undergo change require a sustaining cause.
Yeah.
Existential inertia just directly challenges that. I mean, at least... existential inertia just directly challenges that because it says, why think that? I mean, things may very well just persist without requiring a sustaining cause. That doesn't mean that they persist without an explanation, mind you.
Right.
Because there are explanations that are non-causal. There are buttloads of non-causal explanations. This is a perfectly kosher point. This is uncontroversial in the philosophy of explanation literature, etc. It's like there are explanations that are non-causal, and we cite in chapter, what is it? I should really have these chapters memorized.
Well, Joe, I think even like from a classical theist point of view, if you're going like usually they like Aristotle, and like a formal cause it's not an efficient cause, right?
So, yeah, not an efficient cause in the sense that this argument is talking about. They're talking about efficient sustaining causes. We can clarify that.
Yeah. But so like they should be on board with those kind of things. Like, yes, there are explanations that are not causal, even though like we're equivocating on causal language right now. But a formal cause is not that kind of thing.
Yeah, aitia, which is the Greek word for the what they use for like the formal cause, etc., is better translated as explanation, in fact.
Yeah.
It's like a formal explanation.
Right. So
yeah, there are non-causal explanations. And in chapter 6, we go through a bunch of different explanations, even of these inertially persistent objects, so objects that persist inertially.
Yeah.
We go through explanations of them, even at non-first moments of their existence. So existential inertia does not say that their persistence is brute. It does not say that their existence at non-first moments is brute.
Yeah.
It's perfectly compatible with them having an explanation. And in fact, we systematically provide well over a dozen kind of like explanations that could be given, and we group them into different like accounts. So some of them are in terms of like tendencies or dispositions that the object possesses. Some of them are in terms of like causal relations, efficient causal relations that are cross-temporal or that span different times, rather than being a kind of hierarchical sustaining cause, but rather like the different, shall we say, stages of an object's life. And this can actually be cast in endurantist or perdurantist terms. The different stages or phases of an object's life are themselves related by causal relations of production.
Yeah.
So that's another view. Still other views say that, well, like, it's explained by the fact that persistence is the absence of change. You know, when something's persisting, it's just like remaining in existence. It's not like it's changing in any way,
right,
qua persisting object. Now, it might be changing in ways that are unrelated to its very existence, but in terms of its existence, it's unchanging.
Yeah.
And you might think that it's just part of the very nature of change that something that is unchanged is going to stay unchanged unless, you know, something kind of disrupts it from that state.
Yeah.
And that kind of falls out of certain even explanatory principles that some of these arguments use, as we argue in chapter 4.
Yeah.
So there are lots of, and that's just a small survey. You can also appeal to laws of nature. You can appeal to metaphysical necessity, like lots of different explanations. So you can target that premise, which says that things that can change require a sustaining cause, and you can offer an explanation to boot. You can offer an explanation of why they do, in fact, persist.
Yeah.
That makes no reference to sustaining causes.
Yeah.
And once we do that, then I think that this argument just loses all of its force, at least by my lights.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's good, man. That's really helpful. I'm tempted to dive back in, but we got a bunch more arguments to cover. So let's look at the third one, the Neoplatonic proof, which reasons from composite beings to an absolutely simple being. Yeah, so how do these two clash?
Yeah, so again, I'm going to give a simplified version of this argument, and it's going to sound very similar to the previous one. That's because it actually is really similar, ultimately. It says that, hey, there are composite things, and we're not just talking about physically composite, like here's a right hand and then a left hand. These are physical objects.
Yeah.
But like also metaphysically composite. Now, you might be suspicious of metaphysical composition, as I am, because that's kind of like a constituent ontologist notion, and we might be good Platonic relational ontologists,
as one
should be, but no, or one should be, or one might be a nominalist, which is the second best option. Platonism, nominalism. Those are two best, but anyway, Platonism is better. We've already covered this stuff. I'm going to stop. Okay. But anyway, he talks about physical composition, but he's also talking about metaphysical composition as well. So things having like different properties, like form, or I know that's not really property, but different metaphysical constituents, like form and matter, or et cetera. So there are composite things. But every composite thing requires a sustaining cause at each moment at which it exists. And that means that there are chains of sustaining causes of composite things, and those cannot go on to infinity. You have to have a first cause, so he argues. And because composite things require a sustaining cause, and this thing doesn't have a cause, it follows that it is non-composite. And hence, we have an absolutely simple first primary cause of things. Yeah. That's the basic thrust of the argument.
Well,
again,
Joe, like,
it's almost identical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the sustaining cause meant, or the sustenance like condition, is that meant to like say that these, since it's composite, something needs to continue holding them together lest they fall?
Yeah, so there are slightly different motivations in each of these, like slightly different motivations in each of these cases for that premise, which is like the EIT denying premise.
Right.
In this case, one of the motivations is a kind of like, an explicability requirement. It's like, why are its parts combined even at that non-first moment of its existence? Like, why are they all together? Why are they there the way that it is?
Mm-hmm.
You need some kind of outside cause that conjoins them together and holds them together as the thing persists.
Yeah.
Now, why you can't have an internal cause of that, or like, like certain attractive forces within the thing in question, let's not get into that criticism because that successfully rebuts it on its own right.
Yeah,
but, you know,
sure.
Go into the book for people who are curious about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there are different motivations, as you point out. That was a perceptive point. And in this case, it is about like what explains the unity, the togetherness, the compresence of those parts, whether they be physical or metaphysical parts. So that's the proof. And again, it's not terribly unclear how existential inertia challenges that. It challenges that premise, which requires a sustaining cause. I mean, the audience is probably starting to see a pattern, and that pattern is precisely the persistence argument pattern that I gave at the beginning. Again, there are entities of kind K, and you just basically fill in what that K is, and you say that they require a sustaining cause. Sustaining causes, chains of sustaining causes cannot be infinite. So there's a first uncaused clause, and that can't be of that kind because that kind requires a cause. And so we have a first cause that is not of that kind.
Yeah.
Again, all the persistence arguments basically follow this schema. So much so, in fact, that one of the, like, not anonymous referees for Fazer's book, but like one of the people who publish a review. So this is a professional philosopher. His name is Logan Paul Gage. I believe that's his name. I believe that's how you pronounce
it. It's an interesting name to have in this day and age. Logan Paul Gage. Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. And he published a review of Fazer's book. And he basically says, and again, I'm paraphrasing, so don't take this as a quote of Gage, but he's like, there are two arguments in this book, not five proofs. There are two.
Yeah.
One of them is basically like, hey, certain kinds of things require sustaining causes and those can't be infinite, etc.
Yeah.
And then the other one is the Augustinian proof. So like, this is not just me who's like saying that like they're really sketchy similarities here. They're not actually like properly independent, right? Like they all rest on pretty similar assumptions and they're all targeted. We make this point in a footnote as well, but like a few criticisms apply to like four of these and just like knock them essentially.
And a couple of them, I think like the Thomistic proof depends on it. You know, maybe the Aristotelian proof, or like there a couple of them are built on top of each other. So you take this one out, then like they both fall together.
Oh, especially their second stage. Yeah. So the second stage, all of them, all the second stages of all the proofs rely on the Aristotelian proof. That's why we only have a chapter on the Aristotelian proof second stage and me say like, hey, this doesn't work.
Yeah. Which is good. So, but like, it actually is important for you to go through and show the work, like, because we could say it and be like, look, they all fall to this. Okay, but show it. Okay, so we'll show it, you know. So actually it is actually really important for you to go through and show how each one does fall,
even though
it might be tedious to the, you know, but it's not, it's good because they all do fall by the same thing, but they fall in different ways a little bit.
Yeah And again, I'm like, I don't want to fall into the same traps that as part of the motivation for me writing this book, right? I don't claim that like existential inertia is like a decisive demonstrative disproof of these arguments. Metaphysics is really hard. I'm trying to do it my best. and this is where I have landed, and I am totally open to belief revision, etc. These arguments that I've developed and the criticisms that I've developed strike me as convincing, but I'm not going to say that they're insuperable or that they make people who disagree irrational, etc.
No, and even with this last one, with the Neoplatonic proof, like, it's so fascinating that it's so open to a theistic response as well. Like, well, God made it that way, or God made it such that intrinsically it holds together. Like, and you could give some other principle too and make it sound better too. But like, that one just seems so open to be like, why is it like that? Without God actively holding it together. Well, because God can design stuff that holds together lest destructive force hits it.
And I just want to say, sorry to interrupt, but that's a really, really good point. And that's like another one of the central criticisms of a lot of these arguments that we put forward is like the non-classical theist actually has really good responses to these arguments because they have a principled foundation for reality, like this perfect, unlimited, axiologically supreme, uncaused, necessary being. Even if it's temporal, even if it can undergo accidental change, even if its essence is numerically distinct from its existence, maybe those aren't even metaphysical parts in reality to begin with, but set that aside. Even if it is composite, air quotes on composite, in the sense of, wow, it's omniscient, it's numerically distinct from its omnipotence, okay. They still have pretty good responses to these arguments because they're like, it's no surprise. There's no mystery as to why like God's properties are united together, like why omniscience is found together with omnipotence and so on. I mean, some of these are mutually entailing. You can have a unifying explanation in terms of, for instance, God's perfection. You can have whole to part grounding. So God as a whole grounds his various parts, quote unquote parts, again, in the classical theist sense. I don't think non-classical theists should grant that these are parts, but set that aside.
Yeah.
As you're pointing out, like non-classical theists also have like distinctive responses to these arguments. And yeah. it's like, like God can explain the unity of these objects, as you were pointing out. And also like the quote unquote unity of God can be explained in terms of like God's perfection or like God himself as a whole apart grounding or, you know, like lots of other explanations.
Yeah, no, dude, I think you're totally right on that. And even like thinking through like ideas of like inseparable parts and
yeah.
like, yeah, like, Mereology, yeah, has some good stuff to say here, which doesn't need to be ruled out beforehand. But another thing that's pretty fun here is, like, if you are a non-classical theist, then you have to adopt, if you're going to use these arguments, then you have to retool them, at least a little bit, because, like, he's meaning these to prove a classical theistic God. So like if you're a neoclassical theist, then you don't get to just take these, like you got to adopt them. They're not just stock arguments for you, which I think not enough people recognize, where they'll like throw a bunch of arguments together. And this is something you point out all the time where it's like, hey, these point to different, these go different directions. Like mm-hmm. you don't get to just slap these all together. You need to retool them and do that hard work. Go ahead and do it. But like just throwing out a list where they prove different models of God is not that great.
Yeah, exactly. And that point is just so underappreciated by so many people. It's like, you know, it's totally fine and indeed advisable to mount cumulative cases in favor of views, right? Yeah. That is how we do theory comparison. That is how we come to conclusions. We bring together a total range of evidence and arguments, etc. But you got to be careful that your arguments aren't supporting different, like, just incompatible models of God. Yeah. Some of them might be, like, really highly dependent on, like, a pretty good knowledge of God and God's having intentions and God's being a mind, et cetera, yeah. whereas other ones might pull very strongly against that. Yeah. And they might even, you know, some of them might imply that there are things within God that are numerically distinct from God,
yeah.
like numbers or propositions or abstracta, whereas others, like four of Fazer's proofs, are going to imply that no, there's nothing intrinsic to God that is distinct from God, etc. So like you got to be very careful when you're mounting cumulative cases and getting theistic arguments on your back, because they might actually conflict with one another.
Yeah, well, and like like even if you're a classical theist,
like Fazer, we argue that his right. Augustinian proof conflicts with his four
exactly.
other proofs.
Right, and it's because he wants to be a realist about these things. But if he were to take, like, you know, Brian Leftow's view, not that it's not going to have its own problems, but saying, like, well, I'm an anti-realist about this. And it's kind of like realism, but it's definitely not, because these thoughts are not, you know, you'd have to do that in order to even be a classical theist and appropriate that. So it's just fascinating, man. I'm with you on this. I like it because I think it elevates the conversation. And I'm excited to see people come back from this and be like, all right, well, here, I took it seriously, and here's what I got for you, Joe. Like that'll be sick to see that. Lord willing, that's gonna happen. Like hopefully people do take it seriously and don't just go, ah, freaking Joe. Let's skip the Augustinian proof, unfortunately. But we've talked
about
it.
We did a whole video. Yeah. Let's plug that video. Everyone, go check. I loved it so much that I was like, I'm posting this on my channel. Yeah. And
I've gotten so much good feedback. People really enjoyed that episode. I loved it too. But so the Thomistic proof, which reasons from essence existence composites to a being in which essence and existence are identical. Help us out, man. Yeah, what do we think?
I'm going to sound like a broken record, but yeah, this argument starts with the claim that there are things in which essence and existence are distinct. Then it basically says, again, this is a paraphrase, and I'm not, yeah. you know, look at the book if you want to get the proof, totally. And et cetera. Then it says, things in which essence and existence are distinct require a concurrent sustaining cause at any moment at which they exist. Those chains cannot be infinite. Therefore, there is a first cause, and because things in which essence and existence are distinct require a sustaining cause, and this thing doesn't have a sustaining cause, it follows that its essence and existence are not distinct. That is, they are identical. And so then there is this thing in which essence and existence are numerically identical, and allegedly, this is God. And you can see how existential inertia challenges that. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of other challenges as well. Like, you might come equipped with a non-Thomistic understanding of existence, yeah. as I do. You might reject ontological pluralism, as I do. You might reject Thomistic understanding of essence, as I do. You might reject, and so on down the list. You might think that conclusion doesn't get you to God, as I do. Yeah. You might think that that conclusion is actually, well, maybe I shouldn't go there. I was going to say, like, we have a footnote in this book. Let me see if I can find it. We have a footnote in this book where, like, actually, no, I think it's in the Neoplatonic proof chapter, where we're like, actually, maybe, like, a more plausible conclusion of some of these arguments is atheism, because they get you to this, like, absolutely simple being. But you might think that were God to exist, he'd have to be some kind of plurality. Maybe a plurality of concepts he'd have to have, maybe a plurality of thoughts, maybe a plurality of divine persons, maybe a plurality, like, at least a plurality of something, yeah. You might think. In order for God to be, like, truly personal, like, he has to have a plurality of something, maybe yeah. desires, maybe intentions, etc. But then, like, just by the Neoplatonic proof's own reasoning, what combines that plurality? What keeps it together? What explains why the plurality, why the elements of the plurality are unified as they are? If it's okay to cite one of the members of that plurality in the case of God, and then you can just do that in the case of the composite things, right? Yeah. You can cite one of the members of that plurality to explain why they're united. You can have an internal explanation.
Yeah.
If they're nothing that explains it, then you can say that about some kind of foundational thing that's in the, you know, that's composite, etc. So, like, if you take the argument to its natural conclusion and follow its reasoning where it naturally leads, we argue, or at least I would argue personally,
yeah.
perhaps this, I say perhaps multiple times, perhaps the best conclusion to draw here is atheism. There is just this atheistic, impersonal, Neoplatonic one. And it's like unity itself. It's being itself. It's impersonal. It yeah. doesn't care about us at all, etc. That seems to be a much more natural fit with the first stage of these arguments by my lights. And then you don't get into all these problems about contingent knowledge, God's contingent knowledge, and like God somehow being personal, you know, trying to all, you know, trying to square all the circles that you try to do with classical theism.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about God's changing knowledge of a changing creation because, like, this thing doesn't have any knowledge. You don't have to worry about relating to this, you know, impersonal being itself, which doesn't have any, you know, real relations, and it's not really affected by us because it's impassible. Like, our prayers don't have any yeah. effect on it, etc. So, like, you don't even have to worry about all that. Just say that it's an impersonal, atheistic, mindless one. And you get all these classical theistic arguments, all the stage ones, you get all that. And stage two itself doesn't even work, as we argue. So perhaps, I'm emphasizing perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps these are good arguments for atheism. So
I thought that about I thought about Graham Oppy's view of, like, necessity, the branching one, right? It's Neo-Aristotelian, mm-hmm. and it's like this. I don't even know what to call it, right? I don't know if it's like a thing or whatever, but it's like the is it just the universe itself? And it's like,
oh, his all, initial all singularity?
The, yeah, the initial singularity. Like, I can't remember if it's like it's a concrete thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is it the universe itself?
That might depend. That might depend on whether we're whether we are B theorists or A theorists, right?
Yeah,
so if we're B theorists, that'll just be an initial segment of the universe, presumably. If we are, and Oppy likes B theory, and if we are atheists, or at least non-eternalist atheists, then it's not going to be, I'll say presentist. If we're presentists,
yeah, sure.
then it'll presumably exhaust the universe at the early stages.
Yeah. So yeah, all that to say, like, yeah, that is fascinating that it might do that. That's why, man, I always go for, like, a Trinitarian view if I can, because that's the kind of God I believe in. So I'm like, well, let me think through that. Like, Chad McIntosh in his dissertation goes in, like, for metaphysical grounding, and is like, well, it has to be three things metaphysically grounded. It's like, okay, that's an argument. That's fascinating. Let's look at that more. But yeah, I've always been kind of nervous about classical theism because of certain reasons like this, and like all my favorite arguments are like anthropological ones, like the argument from reason and consciousness and all these kind of things where you're like, but then you kind of like cut off this thing by saying God's not a person like us, and you're like, well, dang it, you guys. So yeah, I feel that. That's a fascinating point. Rationalist proof, which reasons from contingent beings to a necessarily existent purely actual being. Man, so the actus purus thing, like that, and like God being itself. Yeah.
That comes out of nowhere in this particular proof. Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry. This is one of the most frustrating parts of the book where I was writing this. I'm like, okay, Fazer, you know, uses the PSR, gets to a necessary thing. Mm-hmm. Like, people who know me know that, like, I'm generally sympathetic with some contingency arguments. Some contingency arguments I'm totally cool with in general. I'm sympathetic, I should say.
Yeah.
You know, there are
a certain type of PSR like that you're cool with that. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like it gets to a necessary concrete thing. And like in the book, we're like, yeah, we're just going to grant you that. Like we're not going to challenge your PSL. We're not going to do any of that. Like I don't really have any bones to pick with that. So he gets to this necessary thing. And then he's like, it has to be purely actual then. Where does that come from? And, okay, his argument is like, well, if it weren't, then it'd have potentialities that need to be actualized in order for it to exist. In which case, it wouldn't be the first, you know, foundational thing. There'd be something that actualizes its potentiality for existence. And it's just so utterly strange. Like, it doesn't follow from the fact that it's not... It doesn't follow from the fact that it's not purely actual, that it has potentials that need to exist in order to be that need to be actualized in order to exist. No, its potentials are for accidental properties that it could gain or lose.
Yeah.
None of those need to be actualized in order for this thing to exist.
Yeah.
So it's just the strangest argument. It's so overwhelmingly bad. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just this is one of those cases where I'm like, I really can't see it, and it seems really implausible to me. Again, I will stress that I could totally be wrong here. I could be missing something. I want to emphasize that. It's important to emphasize intellectual humility and to try to cultivate it, and I can lose it, and I can fail to exhibit it. It's just in this case, it really does strike me as so wrong. But again, I could be mistaken. But again... Yeah.
Well, okay, so that is a really huge benefit to having someone criticize your stuff, because if you're in a room of people who agree with you, they'd be like, yeah, for sure, because I also hold that view. Like, I actually, mm-hmm. I made that argument that I've been presenting for God from Donald Davidson's triangulation argument. I tried this move way back in the day, like a couple years ago, and James Anderson was like, what? You can't do that one. And I was like, yeah, but I just wanted to slap it on because I thought it would be like a nice little like, yeah. And if he had to, you know, if he had to depend on someone to communicate with, and that was an essential property, and it was all these ands, and it also didn't follow. And I was just like, okay. And he like, a couple of my philosopher friends just were like, dude, that's not good. And so I understand it and I get it, why it's like, okay. And there's this added thing where like you need to be just pure actuality, because then you wouldn't be dependent on the creature. And it's like, yeah, that's a theological point, and I get it, and I see wanting to add that on, but you can't just slap it on if it doesn't fit, because someone's going to come along and they're going to slap you for doing that and it doesn't look good. So I definitely like resonate with it, but I'm also glad that you're like, I don't think so.
So I mean, that's one problem that I have. I mean, it's almost like a small point in that chapter, because, like, I mean, again, a broader point is like Fazer uses the PSR to try to argue that things require like some kind of, let me see if I can pull up the chapter. But anyway, it's, again, he talks about this sustaining causal explanation, but it's like, again, there are explanations that don't cite this kind of sustaining efficient cause. And we argue that alone is going to be able to allow us to account for the existence of these objects at non-first moments of their existence. You don't need to appeal to some kind of sustaining cause. So this one, again, falls into that category of persistence arguments that we challenge. And so, again, it's going to succumb to the existential inertia challenge. I mean, we should emphasize for the audience, of course, that, you know, Fazer has written and published arguments against existential inertia directly. But we should also mention for the audience that I have like dozens of pages addressing those. So so check out the chapters, so people don't think like, oh, you're ignoring that he published this paper. And he, as I know the ire and the wrath of internet Thomists, I have been indelibly marked by it. And so I just wanted to say that, yes, I recognize that he has published on criticisms of existential inertia directly, and we're not talking about those here. If you want to look at those, my responses, check out the book.
Yeah. Joe, it's got to be like a good feeling being able to have the academic work like literally in your hand, being like, it is right here. Sometimes it's hard to talk about certain ideas because you're like, look, I can't, this is a podcast, so like I can't give you all the propositions right now and the footnotes. even if I read them, like, it just, you would be bored. It would not work any longer. But having them being able to be like, I have the work. You can buy the book and look it up. It's got to be like, it got partially freeing at least, because you can go like, hey, look, here's a rough sketch, but I can do that because I've also done the hard work. It's right here. Like, that's gotta, it's got to feel good.
Yeah, well, exactly. And speaking of the book, so we both forgot about this at the beginning, but for the audience, check the links in the description. I'm doing I'm doing this work for Parker.
Yeah, yeah.
Check the links in the description. There'll be stuff that you can click on to go and get the book. The hardcover, I mean, I don't have control of the prices. Springer primarily serves libraries. That's why it's so expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have control of the prices. The hardcover is going to be $150, so don't get the hardcover. The softcover on Amazon is only $56. For an academic book, that is not unreasonable.
No,
okay, that's not unreasonable for an academic book. Only $56. Yeah. It's 378 pages, and I really do think it'll serve you guys. Whether
I was gonna do this at the end, man. You gotta there's a whole pattern to it to get them off. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, whether or not just whether or not you're a classical theist or a non-classical theist, I really do think it'll serve you. It's quite long, and we give a very good hearing to like classical theists themselves. You'll often hear, and I think this is a quite right criticism, that you'll often hear that certain popular presentations from atheists and non-theists of the five ways and of classical theistic proofs, they miss certain things. Like, they'll talk about, oh no, these things are trying to prove the beginning of the universe. I'm like, no, that's not what they're trying to do. Like, they miss a lot of things. And so we really try to listen to the classical theists themselves, to give them a voice and to respond in the way that we think that they deserve, because this is a robust intellectual tradition and we respect it. And we're going to give it the time that it deserves, and we're going to give it the critical attention that it deserves. The book-length critical attention that it deserves. Like Oppie and Sobel and these people, they're writing books on general theism. They're not really even going into the specific models of God, which afford different arguments and different maneuvers to respond to objections and things like that. We wanted this to be a systematic critical appraisal of like central classical theistic, specifically classical theistic proofs, because there really isn't one on offer on that. So this is kind of like a unique book in that. And that's why I think it'll serve both classical theists and non-classical theists. And again, we give classical theism, at least by my lights, we give it the respect that it deserves in this book. And I mean, criticism is a form of respect, right? Especially among philosophers, because you're respecting enough to give it the time of day, give it the light of day, and to think about it really hard and to, you know, publish your criticisms of it.
Yeah.
So ultimately in the service of, you know, trying to help us all get to the truth of the matter. So, yeah.
Yeah, I caught that in the intro too. It was cool seeing like the different things, like your aims and goals and stuff like that, and just being like, yeah, we're trying to serve truth. I really like that. It is a really fascinating point that you just mentioned, that like a lot of people on both sides want the most bang for their buck. If I'm going to write a book, if I'm going to do, like, I need this to be very, very broad scope. And like, I get this because I like transcendental arguments. So like, I want everything with one argument. So I get that. And so it is a really cool thing that you're doing. That's like, no, we are focusing in on this, and actually it will have broad scope because there's plenty of theists who are non-classical theists and like classical, like it is really good for everyone, but it's actually like a finer point of philosophy of religion, man. It's at the nexus of like analytic theology and philosophy of religion type stuff, which is cool. Like
that's why I loved like writing this. I love these sorts of areas. Like, where does this book fall into? Yeah. Well, on the Springer page, and we had a say in what goes on that Springer page. We didn't had a say in all of it. The keywords on the Springer page are hilarious. They're so funny. One of them is like, because we talk about existential inertia, like some of the typesetters, we didn't have any say in the words that they put up there for like the keywords, you know, for articles you do, but for this book, apparently we didn't. So they had like existentialism or something as one of them, existentialism as one of the keywords. And I was like, that's not, but
that's
okay.
Tough.
But anyway, yeah, but like, where does this fit in? Like, well, as we say on the Springer page, like it's metaphysics, it's philosophy of religion, it's philosophy of time. Those are the main areas, but it's like, this goes into like lots of different things. We got philosophy of physics in here. There's some philosophy of science in here. There's a lot of metaphysics in here. There's philosophy of time, which is like kind of sub-branch of metaphysics. There's a lot of philosophy of religion, of course, and models of God, but also thereby analytic theology.
Yeah.
There is like, it's in a lot of different areas, and we pursue them in a lot of depth in many cases. So it's like, it's both broad, but also like narrow in the same sense. Like it's focused on classical theistic proofs, but it's also focused on like existential inertia and why things persist and those debates. So it like brings in debates and kind of weaves them together and puts them in communication with one another in ways that I hope the audience will find illuminating.
Yeah. And I think they will, especially my audience, but that's something I really enjoy about, philosophical theology, philosophy of religion, analytic theology, like there's just so much on the table And depending on the book, depending on the article you're writing, like, you're going to have to draw in a ton of stuff from philosophy and sub-disciplines in philosophy. And if you're a theist, like, then there's a lot on the table too, where you're like, well, I also have to, like, bring in my tradition, because I'm a part of a tradition. I can't say certain things. Should I be able to say certain things? Well, maybe not. And like, the whole thing's cool, man. I love that. So sometimes we've talked about this before. Sometimes I have the inner Parker who's like, oh, philosophy of religion. I'm like, wait, no. That's why I actually care about time and all this other stuff too. So, I love it, man. I'm grateful for the service that you're doing here. We got one more, Aquinas' De Ente argument, which reasons from creaturely composition of essence and existence essay to an absolutely simple being of pure essay. So hit me.
Well, this one is one of the most complicated out of all of them. So it's sort of like, it's a lot similar to the Thomistic proof that we read. So Fraser bases his Thomistic proof, it's his own distinctive argument, but it's largely based on this De Ente argument that's originally found in Aquinas and that's developed, I think, most forcefully and carefully in Gavin Kerr or Kerr. You can pronounce that. I've heard it different ways. I think I've asked him before, and he said, I think if I recall correctly, he said either is fine. I think
that helps.
So I was like, that makes it well. Yeah. Helps. I mean, it makes it worse. I know. Some people are like, right. People are like Kerr. Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. You're being sarcastic. Yeah. Some people say Kerr, and others like Kerr, and I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. For some reason, you know, whenever we're reading, we almost like form an initial word. At least I do this. Like an initial impression of what a word like should be.
Yep.
And for me, I think it should be like care. Like it seems care to me. Like care seems so weird. But
I'm with you on that. Yeah, I think the same thing. Yeah.
That's
right. That's the initial. Everyone adds an L. It's always settle case.
Settle okay. Case.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So yeah, I mean. I can't hope to give this one the attention that it deserves in this forum here, but like, it's very similar to the Thomistic proof. It's basically saying there is this distinction, a real distinction in things between their essence, that is what they are, and their existence, that is that they are, the fact that they are, or this principle of actuality, that whereby a thing is at all in reality.
Yeah.
So there's this distinction between their whatness and their isness, their essence and their existence. And then based on various different justifications, they say that anything which is like that, which is such that its essence and existence are distinct, requires a concurrent sustaining cause. And again, there are different justifications. They don't just flatly assert that. And we look at the justifications extensively in our book. And so they go on this sort of reasoning that, well, if it exists through another, per aliud, if it exists, if these essence existence composites exist through another, through only the activity of a sustaining cause, ultimately you're going to have to get to something which doesn't exist through another, which doesn't derive its causality, doesn't derive its existence from any other thing. And since everything in which essence and existence are distinct does indeed derive its existence from another in that sort of way, it follows that this first underived thing is such that its essence and existence are numerically identical. And this is where you get the kind of ipsum esse subsistens, the subsistent act of being itself. Now, there's actually a little illicit slide there from identical to its own act of existence versus identical to existence itself.
Yeah, right.
That's a little bit of a slide.
Yeah.
But
and the second one, like, I'm not sure how everyone's so comfortable with that, all the theists. Like, to me, it just intuitively seems not right to say that like his essence is existence itself, because you're like, but I exist, and like, do that sounds like pantheism to me, you know. And I know that there's like certain ways of getting around that and stuff, but
yeah, they like they distinguish between like different kinds of existence, and so like you're gonna there's this esse commune or like communal existence or the existence that you and I have.
Yeah.
But then there's esse tantum, which is God's existence, which is a different existence.
Right, but it's not. But then, like, that's not existence itself, right? Like, because so it's like, okay.
And it almost deprives it if it's, like, mystical. You know, like, people say this and they're like, oh, existence itself, man. They,
I know.
Like, light a bong or something. And then.
It's true.
And then they're like. And then you press it a little bit further, and it's like, it's actually not as mystical and supreme and transcendent as you think it is. It's like, oh, well, you know, God has his own act of existence. And he's kind of like, it's almost like this little trope with which God is identical to his own act of existence. And it's like, I mean, okay, fine. Everything else exists in some sense by participating in that act of existence and by relation to it and deriving our existence from that thing. Okay. But it's like, theists have always held that. I mean, this is like, where is the kind of distinctive mystical cool transcendence from you get from saying this? Like, it doesn't have the same ring when you kind of spell it out as like, oh, God is being itself. But then you have to kind of say, well, he's identical to his own act of existence. And yeah, we're all like related to it in a pretty cool way. But it's not our existence. He isn't this it's not as mystical as it sounds when you start to get out of like the kind of pantheistic those sorts of.
Yeah. Well, if we went in for like idealism and we're like, we're ideas in God's mind, you could do some of that and you'd be like, yeah, like I only exist because I'm his thought, but then like, you'd have to say like, well, God is identical to his thoughts. And you're like, well, but then how many billions of people are there on the earth right now? Just people. So then, you know what I mean? And it's like, well, then I'm Joe. Then me and Joe are just one. And you're like, well, no, that can't work either. Like, and I have my own thoughts and they're different than Joe. And maybe I can dream up a fake world right now with billions of people. Like, it's just tough. I just think that one's so tough to be like, yeah, his essence is existence. And then it dies 1,000 qualifications. But
And I just wanted to clarify that earlier I was not attributing to the Thomists who run this argument a trope theoretic account. That was just an analogy, if you will, as to how one way that one might think that this sort of looks from the outside, it sort of looks like a trope theoretic account of existence where we each have our like essays, our individual acts of existence, and those are not God's act of existence, right? They have to be distinct because God is not like an internal composing principle of us, whereas our existence is. So I just wanted to say like that was just an analogy. I'm not attributing to them a trope theoretic account. Yeah. I just wanted to say that because, again, like I said, the wrath of the internet Thomists will pour forth upon you.
They might say hexaity, say like but if they're Thomists.
Oh, I listened to that one. I listened to that discussion you had with Ward, and they talked about hecate and hexaity.
Yeah. That's so good. That's funny. You listen to that one. Yeah, that's so good, man. Well, dude, I appreciate the book. I haven't, like I told you earlier, like it's so good. And I was like, I could force myself through this, but I didn't want to do it. So I did give it a good analytic skim, and we have talked about this and stuff too, but I'm really excited to like go back and actually just give it the old, like legit read. I'm very excited that the soft cover is not like super duper expensive. For some people, they might be like, yeah, that's expensive. But like, if you're used to buying academic books, then that is not expensive. I encourage everyone to grab that book for whatever reason. Like, there's a bunch of reasons you should grab that book, but it's going to be dependent on you. If you're a classical theist, this can help you think through your position. If you're a non-classical theist, like, why aren't you? Well, there's some good reasons right there. And like, maybe you like some of these arguments, but you don't want to get slapped by existential inertia stuff. Maybe you like existential inertia. Well, grab that and see why the arguments fail and retool them for arguments for God's existence. Like, whatever. If you want a good argument against classical theism, grab the book. If you just want to like good old fashioned learn some philosophy and stuff, like grab the book. So there's many reasons to do it. So
I should also clarify. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. I appreciate it. And I should also clarify that. You could check your local library or institution to see if they have institutional access to Springer ebooks. So here's the thing. Springer, as I said, they primarily serve libraries. And, you know, that's, of course, both local libraries as well as university libraries. And many libraries have purchased the what's called Springer ebook packages. Mm. So it's basically like an agreement where Springer will, like, give this institution or this library and everyone on their like servers or whatever free access to the EPUB version and the PDF version of the book, as well as the ability to purchase what this is. It's a My Copy. It's like an individual use. Anyway, it's only like $40. And so, check your local library and see if they give you access to it. If you have their like library codes or if you're associated with an institution, go to make sure you log in through your institution or whatever, or you're on their Wi-Fi or whatever, and go to the Springer page for the book and see if you have that, because it'll give you the option to download the book onto your laptop for free. because you are associated with the library, which has bought the packages. So that's at least a way to get the ebook for free. Yeah. If you have the institutional, you know, association or affiliation. So Purdue, for instance, Purdue has that. And so like the day this came out or whatever, I was like logging into my, even though I graduated, I still have like the library codes or whatever. So I was logging into that. I'm like, oh, cool. I get a free PDF and EPUB and everything. Awesome. And you also get access to the My Copy, which is only $40. So I think this is what is sold on Amazon for $56. It says it's the soft cover. And this is, I think, what the soft cover is supposed to look like. Maybe this isn't here. So I think they might be selling the My Copy on Amazon. I don't know. That's $56 on Amazon.
Yeah.
But if you have an institutional subscription or whatever that allows you to get access to it, you can get it for just $40. So
yeah.
It's at least $16 less.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Joe, okay, two more questions before I let you go here. One is a lot of people are interested in like what you're going to be doing and stuff. I usually don't like to date my episodes, but we've talked about so much evergreen stuff already that it's fine. Do you think you'll carry on with existential inertia and this kind of type of argument? Like, would you like to do that in a PhD program, or is this like the culmination and now you're ready to move on to a different topic?
That's a very good question. I honestly don't quite know yet. So this is kind of my culmination, not my culmination of my investigation into like classical theism,
sure.
Because like there are so many papers that I've published on classical theism that don't show up in here. Like we only investigate, I think, like two or so arguments against classical theism. Well, actually, it's a little bit more because two or so families, I should say, of arguments against classical theism in here. One is from changing divine knowledge and another one is from abstract objects. Yeah. Let me give a bunch of different considerations from abstract objects. As people who have followed my work know, I've published lots of other papers on challenges for classical theism. I published On Modal Collapse and the Fruitful Death of It, but also, you know, it's fruitful because it spawns new different arguments, and I've developed those in different papers of mine.
Yeah.
So
we did a podcast episode as well, folks, so go find that. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, this isn't like the culmination of my stuff on classical theism, but like, I think this is sort of like the end point of my stuff on classical theism. I don't know if it's the exact end, but like, I want to get more now into, like, more into, like, metaphysics and infinity. I've got a lot of papers under review right now on, like, causal finitism and infinity and infinity paradoxes and things like that. And I'm very excited. I've got stuff on the modality and Patrick principles and modal ontological arguments under review right now. So branching into stuff like that. I'm branching a lot beyond classical theism. As for existential inertia... Yeah, that's one live topic that I'm considering pursuing during my PhD program. So I just actually applied to grad schools. I just like a couple weeks ago that I just finished my applications. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, what am I going to write my dissertation on? I mean, I don't really know. But again, one topic is existential inertia because there are so many like new avenues that this book opens up. I mean, like, I can explore how the discreteness versus continuity of time affects the debate. I can explore in further detail. So I gave a bunch of different metaphysical accounts, and I didn't usually argue for or against individual accounts, but like comparing the merits of the different metaphysical accounts of existential
compare
inertia.
Compare the
like,
theories, right? Yeah.
Yeah, if we compare the theories, right. That's one topic. I mean, another thing is like I'm really interested in, like I said, infinity paradoxes. So it'd be really cool to do a dissertation on infinity and things like that. So that's another idea that I have in mind. Those are my two main ideas for dissertations at this point.
That sounds awesome.
So it's sort of the culmination of stuff on classical theism, sort of the end of that. I say sort of because, you know, there's still some stuff in the works on that. Not for existential inertia. I'm still going to be working on that.
Awesome. Yeah, I think Ed Fazer is probably happy about that you're moving on. Like, yeah, finally. we'll see. Until he posts something else, and then you're back into the weeds with him. Dude, I saw. When you first sent me this a few, I don't know, weeks back or whatever, I was looking through and I saw in the acknowledgments a familiar name, dude. Thanks so much. That was insane to see my name on there. That was crazy.
Yeah, well deserved. Well deserved. Yeah, you awesome. Inspired some. Good stuff in the Augustinian proof chapter, especially. So
awesome,
yeah,
dude.
We were grateful.
Appreciate it. So last question here is, it might not be in your wheelhouse, but I'm sure you can have some thoughts about it, is like, could you like program a digital Joe or like a digital, would it be concrete if it's digital? Could you program a thing with existential inertia? Because if not, then perhaps we don't live in a computer simulation.
If not, perhaps we don't. Oh, okay. So that's interesting. Could I program something with these? I mean, what are the metaphysics of programs? Do programs even exist?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's just, do they, I mean, that might depend on whether or not how we answer the question of like the metaphysics of material objects.
Chalmers argues that like virtual things are digital things, and digital things, it seems like, and from his arguments, are like obviously real, because there's like digital, like my account is digital with money in it, and it's like, yeah, that exists. So could you make like virtual things? Well, let's assume for the sake of argument that virtual things are digital things and digital things are real things.
Okay.
Could you make like a virtual thing with existential inertia, I guess, like in The Sims or something? I guess you could probably program that, like program it to continue existing unless, a destructive force hits it. And I don't know. Would that program be external to it and holding it in, sustaining it or something?
Yeah, like what's the relation between a program and the contents of it? Sorry. So it sort of depends on the relation there. So, I mean, again, in general, the way that you figure this out for the audience is to look at the thing in question that we're asking whether or not it inertially persists, and you ask whether or not it persists in the absence of an external sustaining cause, so a cause that's kind of outside of it, that's not a part of it, as well as in the absence of like sufficiently destructive factors. So if these things are sort of like functionally realized by something outside of them or external to them, and they're like continuously functionally realized in that manner, then I'd say they don't inertially persist. And maybe they are. I don't really know about the metaphysics of digital objects. So, but like if they're continuously, in some sense, functionally realized by, in some manner, explanatorily dependent on, ontologically dependent on for their existence, something that is disjoint from them, outside of them, then yeah, they're not going to inertially persist. But is the coding like a part of them? Is it like the makeup, the fiber of their being, as it were? Like, we aren't programmed beings, presumably. We have like atoms as parts and things like that, right? So maybe the program to them, or whatever it is that underlies them, maybe it's like the atoms to them. Maybe it constitutes them rather than being an outside thing.
They could just be made up of zeros and ones, no problem, because maybe my desk is made up of zeros and ones, like at the fundamental level, who cares?
Yeah. So long as it's within them, it kind of constitutes them.
But would they be like supervening on the actual like hardware or something? And does that supervention like matter for their just because something like supervenes on something else, does that mean that subvenient base is like responsible for the persistence of the supervening thing?
Well, I mean, that's not in general true, because, you know, supervenience is not like an explanatory dependence relation. Like you can, technically speaking, anything necessary supervenes on anything else necessary. Right. And in fact, anything necessary supervenes on anything, right? Because for A to supervene on B just means there cannot be a change in A without there being a change in B. So if there cannot be a change in A, then clearly there cannot be a change in A without there being a change in B, right? So if something cannot change, as is the case with necessary truths or necessary propositions or things like that, they would supervene on like literally everything.
Oh, wait. Oh, shoot. So like if the law of non-contradiction is necessary, that doesn't seem like that would supervene on anything else. It seems like anything else would supervene on it.
Well, so as I understand supervenience, right? Yeah. A is going to supervene on B, provided that there can be no change in A without there being a change in B.
Right. So like, but if the law of non-contradiction supervenes on something else, then it's like, well, something else is the subvenient base of that, and the law of non-contradiction can't change unless that subvenient base changes. There's a change in that subvenient base. But that seems like the opposite.
Well, yeah, so if there cannot be a change in A, so let's take this formula. There cannot be a change in A without there being a change in B. That just means that, like, necessarily, if there's a change in A, then there's a change in B.
Yeah.
But if A can't change, right,
there's
that antecedent that antecedent is like necessarily false. And whenever you have a like an implication with a necessarily false antecedent, right, the whole implication is going to be true.
Yeah.
So then everything necessary is going to be supervening on anything.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. This is all just like a minor. Point. The broader point is just that like supervenience is not ipso facto an explanatory dependence relation or an ontological dependence relation. In the case of hardware and software, is it? Maybe.
Metaphysical grounding is supposed to be an explanation relation, isn't that right?
Yes. So
if we said that it's grounded in the hardware, then it would be like, okay, this might be a problem.
If the hardware is external to them, yes.
Yeah.
So like existential is perfectly fine with things being grounded in other things, but it's just going to be like, if inertially persistent things are grounded in something else, it's going to have to be something intrinsic to them, something within them. Yeah. So like I might be grounded in my parts and their arrangement, perhaps.
Sure.
Maybe. And like typical cases of grounding are in fact like constitution cases, right? So that's usual. But you know, some people, so the question is the hardware external to whatever the things are that we're talking about? Is it kind of like external to them? Is it outside of them, not part of them?
Seems like, because it seems like it has different properties than they do.
Well, my parts have different properties than me.
Yeah. Okay.
It depends on the metaphysics of digital objects.
Yeah,
so,
I know. It's just tough.
Okay, I guess as I think of it, like a digital object is like ephemeral. Like, I don't know. It's like...
It's
not made up of.
Does it exist in a different way? Like, are you opening up ontological pluralism for me?
No, it does not exist in a different way. It just has really different properties.
Okay.
But if that's the case, if it's like ephemeral, if it's thin, if it's ghostly, then it doesn't seem to be made of the hardware, because that's hard.
Okay.
And if that's the case, well, then the hardware is external to them, and so they would not inertially persist if it's a dependence relation on the hardware, maybe it is. Maybe it probably is.
Sweet. Yeah. Well, this is good. This is good helping us think through. So someone listening, maybe John Connor, I think that's his name, can tell us why on Ontic, do you know the dude I'm talking about on Facebook where he goes in on like Ontic pan computational Aquinas and he'll like go
I do
in
know
and,
who you're talking about.
He'll go in and he'll figure it all out for us. We won't be able to understand it, but if he's listening, you go and do the work. No, someone else though, an existential inertialist might run this argument against simulation hypothesis, and that would be very, very fascinating and might give us reason to another reason to be an existential inertialist.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's the modus ponens way to do it. I mean, I guess you could do the modus tollens and say, therefore, existentialism is false because we live in a computer simulation.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting thought. But I mean, then again, like the hardware and software of which we're familiar. I mean, why should we think that that's the same as what's happening? Like, if we're the programmed beings, like, why would the relation between the hardware and software that we're aware of on our computers, why would that be the same as what's out there, like outside of us in the non-simulated reality? So, this argument does kind of rely on us, kind of it being the same relation there. Because if it's not the same relation, then you don't automatically get a denial of existentialism.
Yeah, but then we also now we have the question of like, well, what do we mean by simulation then? Because we have these simulations, like the Sims, and so like Bostrom is like, yeah, it's just ancestor simulation, and that relation would be the same. Okay, so maybe it's not. So maybe we have reason to not go in for Bostrom's notion of simulation. But then what are we talking about? Are we then saying it's like a metaphor or is it an analogy?
It's an analogical predication. Yeah, maybe it has a univocal core.
There we go, dude. There we go. That's a good point.
Full circle.
I've been pressing that pretty hard lately with people. All right, man. Well, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for the book. It's fantastic. I've loved the chapters that I've read of it, and I can't wait to jump in more to it. Everyone, go and check the link in the description. You can find the book there. And I'll drop an Amazon link. So if you go through my link, it helps support the podcast, but whatever, just get your hands on the book. Joe, drop some stuff for us, like Majesty of Reason. Like where can people find you? I'm sure they already know, but I always want to do it anyways.
Yeah, so people can immediately subscribe and turn on the bell for my YouTube channel, Majesty of Reason, and immediately become a patron.
That's right.
I'm just somewhat kidding, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not. So yeah, Majesty of Reason. I also have a blog by the same name. They could check that out if they're curious. and they can get this book if they're curious. They can send me food and gifts if they want.
That's great.
Send me protein bars, maybe new running shoes. Mm. No, I'm kidding. Yeah,
that's awesome.
That's not what the patron money is being used for, by the way. The patron money is being used to pay off my student debt and also to help me through grad school. And I'm using that education in turn to help people on the internet. So it's, yeah, full circle.
Yeah, that's huge. Awesome, folks. I will drop the link again to all Joe's stuff. That's going to have to do it for now. That was enough. That was good. My brain's on fire. This has been Parker's Pensies. And as always, all glory to God.